What was made public about the event Horizon, that she was a deep space research vessel, that her reactor went critical, and that the ship blew up, none of that is true. The event Horizon was the culmination of a secret government project to create a spacecraft capable of faster-than-light flight.
Excuse me. You see, you can't actually do that.
The law of relativity prohibits faster-than-light travel.
Relativity, yes, we can't break the law of relativity. Can go around it. The ship doesn't really go faster than light. What it does is it creates a dimensional gateway that allows it to jump instantaneously from one point of the universe to another light years away.
How?
Well, it's difficult to... It's all math.
Try us, Doctor.
Right, well, using layman's terms, use a rotating magnetic field to focus a narrow beam of gravitons. These, in turn, fold space-time consistent with Weyl tensor dynamics until the space-time curvature becomes infinitely large and you produce a singularity. Now, a singularity...
Layman's terms.
Well, fuck layman's terms. Do you speak English?
Welcome to Trilogy in Theory. My name is Webb, and this is my co-host, Mike. We continue our descent into hell. We're going back to actually 1995. Paul W.S. Anderson has just come out with the Mortal Kombat movie adaptation.
Oh, joy.
Movie adaptation. Much to the delight of myself and many, many fighting fans. It's campy. It's enjoyable. And it will stick around in terms of like nostalgia and a weird fondness for the rest of time. Especially because Mortal Kombat Annihilation came out like a year or so later and was absolute garbage.
See, let me just produce a possible counter narrative. I think even people who enjoy the first Mortal Kombat from not PTA Paul Anderson, I don't think that it's seen as good. And I think that most people saw Mortal Kombat was like, that was pretty bad. We don't need a sequel. I don't think that it was Annihilation just came in and just ruined the franchise. I think it was just a one and done kind of thing. Like, that's enough Mortal Kombat for now. I say that as, I guess, one of the few people that saw fucking Annihilation. I just watched it like during COVID. I don't know, for some reason, like that one of the great tragedies of the year of 2020 was me deciding, well, I guess it's time to watch Mortal Kombat Annihilation. And it is terrible. It is a step down. I will admit that.
I think also, after that came out, I don't know, maybe audiences were like, well, that was, well, maybe in comparison, they're like, wow, that one, the first one was actually kind of good, because the new baseline.
This guy's a genius.
The new baseline for what it could have been that was shown. But right after that movie, Paul Anderson got a whole bunch of scripts, including the X-Men. And they wanted to go. He wanted to take his time with the X-Men, so he passed on that one.
Not a great career decision, I must say, in hindsight.
I think so.
Considering that they had a pedophile who had a long, successful career just by doing the X-Men series. So, but I appreciate the artistic integrity to choose Event Horizon instead, I guess.
Well, actually, he chose Soldier before he did Event Horizon. But Kurt Russell was like, hey, I need a year to bulk up and get in shape. And he was like, oh, okay. So he pivoted over. He's like, let's do Event Horizon in the meantime while Kurt Russell gets his act together. And that's how we get Event Horizon, which was a kind of still a rushed production from getting the film greenlit to release date, about 10 months. It's mind-bending to me that he could put out this, like, and Wikipedia says $60 million budget for 1997. I feel like that's quite a bit.
Did I read this correctly, that it was because of James Cameron that they were rushed, that this was meant to fill in a late summer release slot that Titanic obviously missed due to its reshoots. It's just, if that's true, it's like, well, we can't have James Cameron's Titanic, you know, the most expensive movie of all time, or at least that's what the publicity said at the time. I mean, obviously we got to go with Paul Anderson's Event Horizon. That's the natural, that's what feel, like, they're not a one-to-one. I don't understand why they just felt like we have to have something out in the market, which is certainly not the case today when they just let nothing come out and are fine with it.
Yeah, 100%. And they actually champion sometimes just like, hey, we can put it up on our streaming platform, and that's just more unique and exclusive content. Like, hey, come watch this. Look, Event Horizon. It came out, didn't make a lot of money, and was critically panned. And I found it years later, I mean, like 1997, I was unable to watch rated R films, and this is very much a rated R film. I absolutely, like, love it. I don't think it's very good. I think it is pretty derivative for the most part, but there's just, it's so enjoyable. Like, I just enjoy all the, because ultimately he wanted to do a haunted house story up in space, which has been done before, and he was really into the
Alien.
Exactly. Yes. Haunting, The Shining, and 2001 are the things that Paul Anderson talks about in the collector's edition Blu-ray. It was like, those were really on my mind at the time. And you can see there's that the blood coming out of the little glass like thing coming out of the same way in Shining. So he obviously gives a lot of reference to these films that he loves.
I've always said Paul Anderson is right there next to Kubrick as far as visual sensibilities. I've always said that.
Well, let's talk about vulgar art tourism briefly. It is a really interesting film movement that I think some people really scoff at. Wikipedia says it's a movement that emerged in the early 2010s associated with championing or reappraising filmmakers, mostly those working in the horror, sci-fi, and action genre, whose work has otherwise received little attention or negative reception to the critical mainstream. So they look at guys like Michael Bay, Paul Anderson, even Carpenter, Corman, De Palma, and they look at their work in complete seriousness. And so I think when you look at Paul W.S. Anderson's filmography, and the Resident Evil series is, I think, a really great example. It was like, yeah, the first Resident Evil isn't great, but take a look at the crap that came out in the next couple of years. For me, Resident Evil 2, they all have different names. Apocalypse, I think, is one of the worst things I've ever seen. It's right up there, I think, on my Mount Rushmore of, like, I can't believe this came out. So there is a craft to Paul W.S. Anderson's work that I enjoy.
Let me, without commentary.
Yeah.
Let me just read his filmography.
Okay.
Mortal Kombat, Event Horizon, Soldier from 1998, Resident Evil, Alien vs. Predator, Death Race, the 2008 version, Resident Evil Afterlife, The Three Musketeers from 2011, Resident Evil Retribution, Pompeii in 2014, who could forget that, Resident Evil The Final Chapter, Monster Hunter, and then he has something in 2024 called In the Lost Lands. Anything good there besides Horizon? That's not like a director that got one shot, and, you know, you see those documentaries like Hodorowski's Dune, for example, where it's like wild, like, imagination, clearly not meant to be boxed in, not going to get financial backing, and just makes his sort of weird art movies. David Lynch is one that you and I sort of talk about off mic, where I'm like, Jesus Christ, he's not made a movie since 2006. Like, he gets a lot of run, he gets a lot of play as far as from other filmmakers, doesn't make movies. And I'm assuming that's because he's choosing not to, because I would think Lynch could get something financed if wanted to.
But again, Twin Peaks. Twin Peaks was an 18-hour project. Keep that in mind. Like that, I know he hasn't done movies, but The Return was a huge undertaking, which he wrote with Mark Frost and directed every single episode.
Does that take him 20 years to do? Like, this is where the blue collar sensibility comes out. It's like, some people go to work every day. Like, every day.
Well, that's the thing.
But back to Mr. Anderson. We're getting off point because I do not want to compare him to Kubrick and David Lynch. All I'm saying is there's enough releasable product in the market where can we safely say this was it? This was the one shining example, because yes, we'll excuse the Resident Evil series because he got bogged down in maybe the money, financially successful, I guess. But what else? Like, to counter that narrative that this guy has not been given his fair shake, he's still getting a lot of work, and I don't know if anybody really goes off about Resident Evil Retribution. I don't. You could correct me if that's the case.
No, I agree with you. I think that his early everything after AVP, I don't really know much about, like, Monster Hunter or even Pompeii. And Pompeii was a big movie with Jon Snow and a few other some major stars, I think.
I watched that one in the theaters, so I'm allowed to talk shit. The other one's not so much, but I did see that one, and I blame MoviePass.
I dig AVP quite a bit. I think it's actually a solidly made movie. And that's the thing with vulgar art tourism, is like, you're really looking at the craft more so than the script. And kind of the and I know that's a weird hey, this is a controversial, you know, film movement. So I don't embrace it completely, but I do see its merits. So this was your first time watching Event Horizon. You did not have the...
I think there was a football player. I think it was Roy Williams. There were a couple different Roy Williams, but I think he was a wide receiver that played for the Detroit Lions. And I think they got beat like 40-7 by the Chicago Bears. And he came out in the post game and said they were lucky, so because we were so close to putting 40 on their ass as well. It's like, we have the numbers, like, we have the scoreboard.
Okay.
And that's kind of like where we ignore the script, we ignore the finished product. It's like, but how? How do we? This is not everybody's Orson Welles, right? Not everybody's just getting their babies just killed, you know, in the womb. But I do, as much as I jest, I admire people who attempt in film circles to look at things that almost immediately are disregarded. Like, the Resident Evil series is probably immediately disregarded. AVP, immediately disregarded by cinephiles. So, I mean, that's cool. If you actually give everything a fair shake. My bullshit meter starts to go up when I hear, like, ignore the script.
I don't want to say ignore the script, but I'm saying that there's still craft in crap. What was your...
I concede that point. I will concede that. Couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, you tell me. This is your first time watching Event Horizon. What is your big takeaway? Like, were you not entertained in the slightest?
Oh, I actually liked the movie. I'm struggling because I obviously with our theme, but many, many years ago, I knew this was about hell. They discover hell or something in some subcapacity. So I don't know when that got spoiled for me. I don't know. Would you even classify that as a spoiler? Like, I feel pretty early on, I'm not thinking this is alien creatures or something. And especially with the, you know, I saw where they were referencing Solaris quite a bit, which is, there's the battle for me. Do you go high-end artsy-fartsy or do we go with the Event Horizon? I'd probably go with Event Horizon there. So I will give at least one win to Mr. Anderson in that regard. But yes, the characters, like, seeing their own, you know, family members, be it, you know, ones that are deceased or not, clearly they're not there on the ship with them. I don't know if I would have enjoyed this better. I think I would have if I had, I was too young. I was not of driving age. If I could have just stumbled into this and be like, what's this sci-fi monster movie? And had that full experience. But I don't know. Do you think it really matters if you know, that it's demonic, what's happening on the ship as opposed to an alien race they've discovered?
Not necessarily, because it is billed as a horror movie. The poster is like infinite space, infinite terror. I mean, that's how it was sold. So you know it's going to go somewhere in the horror genre. The fact that it's in space, I think the alien concept is the most obvious one, and I'm glad it doesn't do that. But I don't think that you have to know nothing going at all. You won't believe it. This movie goes from 0 to 11. No, not necessarily. And they don't explicitly say it's hell. They do say that they went into a dimension. You know, another dimension.
I fucking hope it's hell. I hope there's not another, level down where it's like, oh, you've not even reached hell yet. This is just the appetizer. I also don't know. I don't know if I agree with... there's apparently like lost footage where it would have been more extreme stuff they had to cut for, I guess, tonal reasons. I don't know if it was actually like that it was any more violent than what you see, but I guess they just wanted to pare it down. Like you just didn't want to bathe in the excess violence. I feel like you get a pretty good sense of what we're trying to avoid here. I think it actually does have a really good balance, because I think if they had gone much further and reveling in, I don't know, like watching like rape or people ripping each other's like limbs off, possibly would have been a turnoff for my sensibilities. It seems like the executives also didn't believe in reading the script. And so like when they saw that, they're like, what the fuck is this? Like you can't, this is unseemly. So it's a rare occurrence where I'm thinking a little goes a long way. It's actually like the mood is so great in this movie that I don't really need too many like sort of like flash cuts to like something disgusting, some sort of body horror. Like what I get, I think is fine with me. And you may disagree as a Event Horizon super fan. If you're a big fan of the movie, I get wanting to see whatever extra footage they had, but I actually think that has just the right balance of the horror that they put on display.
It was not only the executives being like, oh, this is kind of unpleasant, let's take it back, but they went through a process with test screenings in which each time they had to cut out more and more. And again, it was a short window to from start to finish, and so they had to kind of do it fast. And I think Paul Anderson said that they had about 2 weeks to cut it down, and it went through three different cuts, and each time getting a little shorter until it was acceptable for release date. Paul W.S. Anderson states that there's a better... he thinks there might have been a better movie in between what we have now and the unedited version, but he loves what ultimately went out. And in order... and
okay, yeah. Cool.
And actually, when the Collector's Edition Blu-ray came out, which was released by Shout Factory... I was like, oh, we're gonna get more of these hell scenes. Not the Holy Grail the way the Magnificent Ambersons Lost cut is, but it still would have been really cool. And he does address it. Oh, I also felt kind of bad because this Blu-ray was done during the lockdowns, and so all the special features are like over Zoom essentially, and so. Paul Anderson over Zoom is just kind of, he said,
I'm telling you, man, 2020, I'm watching Mortal Kombat Annihilation. You're not getting the proper Blu-ray edition. Terrible. Yeah. Just terrible.
Yeah. He does mention that if we wanted to go and do that complete cut, things would have to be reshot. Like that's lost footage, but he still loves and is very proud of what was released. The film is very, very entertaining, very pulpy. And thanks to guys like Sam Neill and Lawrence Fishburne, who bring a lot of legitimacy to something that has, let's face it, no business being this legitimate. I saw The Pope's Exorcism was that what it's called? The Russell Crowe?
The Russell Crowe thing? Yeah.
Garbage, but I'm like, but I had to see it because I was like, why is Russell Crowe in this movie? And Russell Crowe's amazing in this movie. He's speaking multiple languages. He's got the voice, the accent down.
Take that, Mr. Lynch. Some people still have to pay off their mortgage like Mr. Crowe.
He was awesome. And the movie wasn't good, but I was like, this is great. And so it really helps that you've got someone of Lawrence Fishburne's caliber who is channeling that pre-Morpheus vibe, on a ship in space. And Sam Neill is somebody who is very... you empathize with him completely. He has a way about him, I think, in any movie. Even stuff like Dead Calm, which I didn't really like, but you immediately empathize with him. He's very, very good in roles like this. So, at the very least, even in the acting category, you've got some heavy hitters that I think really, really help.
Jolie Richardson, I think, is one that sticks out, according to the commentary track on Event Horizon.
Oh my gosh. I will say, like, yeah, if you want to know more, there's a wealth of knowledge on the Blu-ray. Avoid the commentary because, yeah, it's Paul Anderson and a producer, and the producer chimes in with sexist gems every now and then. And also, they haven't seen the movie in a long time, so there's stretches where they're just watching the movie, and I'm like, can we please? Like,
they're so enraptured by their own work.
I like the idea of, you know, the whole point of the director's commentary is, like, you watch the movie with the director, right? But, like, I don't want to just literally watch. You tell me, when, you know.
So Sam Neill, I guess in this time period, like, I've never seen, is it In the Mouth of Madness?
Yeah.
From 94? So I'm going to, Dave has selected that for the podcast I do with him, Offscreen Death, as one of the best films in 1994, and I allowed it because I've not seen it. So it's like, well, you know, other things that he chooses, like 10 Things I Hate About You as one of the best films of 1999. Maybe a little more questionable. These are the rare times where I wish this was a video podcast, because Webb immediately went into full-on emoji, like, frown face mode. Like, the eyebrows were very much moving. But my point is with Sam Neill, it seems like in his career, he is into going to, like, particularly, like, vile or evil places. Is it Possession? Is that from, like, the early 80s as well? So that seems to be his sensibility for Dr. Alan Grant. I always have a hard time with those characters, though. It's the, you know, it's the mad scientist. It's your fucking Captain Ahab, whatever you want to call it, where it's like, to my own peril. The characters that have, for whatever reason, no sense of self-preservation. Like, we are facing off against hell. The odds are stacked against us. Do we really need some dumbass being like, well, actually, do we need the well, actually guy in the room when people are seeing, you know, their dead or, you know, dying children running around, like, leading them into little Kevin McAllister traps so they can fall into pits. Sorry to, you know, Apollo 13's wife. That was horrible. I hated seeing that. Like, I think that's the only element of the movie that you mentioned. It is very tropey. It sort of hits, you know, all of the beats of sort of what you expect. It's a great amalgamation of, like, other works, which I think is totally fine because it's entertaining in its own right. The Sam Neill character, and it's not in his performance, it's just I hate that type of character so much, which I guess leads you to really love Lawrence Fishburne, because he cares about his people. He won't ask them to do anything that he won't do. I mean, he is the stock hero, which I don't think we often got to see from Lawrence Fishburne, as far as, you know, you mentioned Morpheus, and that he's his own version of a madman. There's always a sense of distrust. Like, is this guy leading us down the wrong path? Can we really believe Neo's the one? And then his, like, early 90s work, I think, is mostly, like, sort of like crime films. So I like seeing him as just, like, a pure stand up dude who's just willing to fight for his people. I mean, at the point where Sam Neill is, like, the blind man, like, babbling on about the glories of hell, about how painful it's going to be. At that point, I give him whatever play he wants to have, because you're full tilt. It's only when, and maybe you can explain it to me as a super fan, at what point does he go from guy protecting his, you know, his creation? Does he go from, you know, Tony Stark and Ultron, where it's like, hey, this is meant to help us. You know, I hate traffic in space. This is meant to get us from point A to point B. To full on, like, recklessly endangering the lives of others. Like, it's not like he has, like, a big speech until he's really, like, demonic, and then he's speechifying, like, out his ass. But, like, it does seem like he's like, well, we need to, like, see what happened, and this is very expensive technology, and I'm letting you in on it. But Yeah. What point in the film do you think he starts to betray, I guess, humanity?
I will say, if there is a weakness in this film, it might be the characterization. It's
Oh, wow. I was actually having an earnest conversation, and I was like, did I accidentally hit on the auteur Paul Anderson's lack of characterization or development?
I mean, you know, it's a 95-minute movie. It is very brisk. And so you've got this cast of characters, and each of them seem to have their own little background in which, I guess, the now sentient ship is exploiting in the hallucinations. And
so his wife's suicide, right?
I guess so. And I wish that it wasn't the wife's suicide. I wish it was something else. I mean, I hate it when films use the death of a child in order as a plot device, but I could see that working a little more here, where, like, hey, he created something, like his child, that, you know, some terrible thing happened and he lost a child, and this is his other creation and he's making up for it in some weird way. There wasn't that sense where you could not understand his point of view at all, right?
There is no Matthew McConaughey behind the bookshelf moment here. Nothing, right. Nothing at all.
Right. And so, yes, I agree with you. He kind of turns into the mustache-twirling villain, for the lack of a better word, in this film, because I guess you need one. If all of the members aboard the ship are on board, I think they get away and everything's fine and there's no real conflict. But you need one person who's just like, no, we got to see this through to the end. And I don't think there is a legitimate reason for that, which, you know, by that point the movie's almost done in 20 minutes, so you don't have time to think about it.
Don't think too much about it, you know.
Yeah,
you went through your popcorn, you know, your soda's low. Let's just wrap this up. So then it gets into, I guess, in the horror community, are the kills cool enough? And you sent me a clip earlier from Family Guy, and that's kind of what I feared with something like Event Horizon, is it has that sort of adolescent, like, wasn't that so sick and twisted kind of bent to it, that you feel like, you know, in the late 90s, if you ran into like a Hot Topic or a Spencer's, they would be raving about fucking Event Horizon, which would have been a total turnoff to me. Like, I'm never watching that fucking movie unless I'm on a podcast, you know, a quarter century later. I felt that it was, that was my fear going into it, that it was going to be a lot of that nonsense that would appeal to like a 14-year-old. I really hate saying this, but I feel like there was an adult in the room, at least here, maybe not with Mortal Kombat, where they went right up to that line and gave you a taste of it and pulled back. I did not feel that was excessive. I see why, like, a teenager discovering this would love it, that sort of, like, hybrid sort of genre that it represents. But I did feel like adults could enjoy this if, you know, now if they went in thinking that it's going to be a space adventure, then yeah, they probably were fucking pissed.
Fair. But that scene that you're talking about, the Jack Noseworthy in the airlock, like, there is a great amount of tension in that scene. And that's, mm-hmm. and that's kind of what you get with Paul W.S. Anderson. He may not give you this Orson Welles, like, masterpiece from start to finish, but you're going to get a lot of set pieces that I think they're going to stick with you. And it kind of speaks to his level of craft. Like, hey, there's something there. And that's what vulgar auteurism is. And at the end of the day, even though it is not something that everybody agrees with, what I like about vulgar auteurism is the fact that it is championing, it is looking at these filmmakers and these films that might not get as much love and saying, hey, take a look at these. I think a lot of the films and filmmakers there appropriately can be labeled as cult filmmakers or cult films, where a lot of the stuff that we see nowadays is like, oh, it was like the films from 1999, every single one seems to be labeled as a cult film, despite the fact that it was a successful and an enjoyable film. This film did not make its money back, got, you know.
I love it. This film was a fucking failure, an honest to God failure.
Yeah, exactly. That the community of genre fanatics have taken upon themselves, be like, no, there is something worth enjoying here. The perfect film that really is a candidate for my old podcast, It's Terrific, where I would try to look at some of these films that do deserve to be loved. Much like In the Mouth of Madness, which was my first ever film that I chose with podcast. Another one that it's not perfect, but John Carpenter's a master craftsman, and he takes some material that may not otherwise have received the same kind of love and attention. So I think Event Horizon will gladly take that cult status place, and I think we're all better spoiled film fans for it existing. So maybe not PTA level, but PTWSA level is just fine by me.
Eventually, there will be a podcast like where its sole theme is comparing the works of Paul Thomas Anderson to, I guess, Paul W. Anderson. And I'm surprised it's not been you, Webb. I'm surprised you have not put on that troll cap and done that service for the internet.
I mean, to be fair, you look at the filmographies as you listed Paul W. S. Anderson's work, and now that I'm listing PTA's work in my head, I'm like, boy, there is definitely a drop-off in quality on one. Meanwhile, the other one's just kind of getting better.
If you had to pick Mortal Kombat's Paul Anderson, what is his phantom thread in his filmography? Does he have anything close to that? One of the Resident Evils, maybe?
I would say Event Horizon is the best thing he's ever done. And I take exception. I would say this is his master, not his phantom thread.
Oh, okay. I was just asking, is there any twisted romance? Because I actually would compare this more to his Boogie Nights, because I feel like you could make this very distasteful in your excess, whether it's the pornography or this, the excessive violence, and I guess the hell rape sex. And both of them gave us just a taste and then managed to pull back and make very entertaining films. This one, probably not as much about... That's strange that when you actually compare them. Boogie Nights is like way more positive about families and adoptive families, whereas this one, it's like if you have a family, it's going to get you fucking killed. Like, if you have any sort of ties, you're dead. Does Lawrence Fishburne have any connection, or is he the one that doesn't?
No. Well, he does have that one backstory where he left somebody behind, and that's his raison d'etre for the film. That's what drives him. But his personal life is not really mentioned. And
can we get into that just for a second?
Yeah.
So his is, he made a decision per his job leadership to save the lives of many over this one, right? And this person haunts them, usually on fire, walks around in flames. Does that make him feel worse, or is it the fact that now, when last he saw this person, that he perhaps grieves that decision he had to make? He sees this person covered in flames, taunting and chasing him, trying to kill him. Does that help him get over that?
I couldn't tell you. And I can't even think of a proper PTA analogy here. You know, somewhere out there, Paul Thomas Anderson's listening to this, and he's like, the fuck are you guys talking about?